This is Susan V. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out. Dr. David E. Nichols, PhD, is currently an adjunct professor of chemical biology and medicinal chemistry at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Eshelman School of Pharmacy. Today, thanks in large part to the ongoing efforts of Dr. Nichols and the Hefter Institute, which he founded in 1993, scores of new studies into the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics are appearing every year from lauded institutions such as Johns Hopkins, the University of New Mexico, UCLA, NYU, and Stanford. And those results are being published in respected peer review publications, even in national media. Dr. Nichols, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And may I add that Dr. Nichols is the keynote speaker Thursday night at the Telluride Mushroom Festival. So we begin with a little background on your life. At what point did your interest in science emerge? Did you set your sights on a career in chemical biology and medicinal chemistry early on?
Actually, when I was younger, I was going to be a physician. But when I took Latin, they said you had to be able to speak Latin to be a doctor, and I didn't do well in Latin, so I said, okay, I'm not going to be a doctor. So in the ninth grade, I got more interested in chemistry and science.
Okay, when and why did psychedelics come into your focus?
It was when I was an undergraduate, and I had a lot of friends. I stayed home and commuted to University of Cincinnati, but I had friends who went to other colleges, universities, and they would come back and we'd get together and they would be telling me about marijuana and LSD, and I had no clue what they were. So I got a book from the bookstore at University of Cincinnati and started reading up and really became intrigued. So in my undergraduate years.
Okay. Would you summarize the key findings of the early research in the U.S. on psychedelics? Results from the studies done back in the 1950s and early 1960s.
Yeah, there were about 1,000 clinical papers published describing treatment of about 40,000 patients for a whole range of things. The studies were fairly rudimentary. They didn't have good controls. And so we really didn't learn a whole lot. There were a lot of really interesting anecdotal reports. Probably the strongest findings were in treatment of using LSD to treat alcoholism, and then in the 1960s, using LSD to treat cancer patients in Baltimore at the Spring Grove Institute there. So there wasn't anything really definitive, but just a lot of excitement and a lot of anecdotal reports that got people very excited about the possibilities, but nothing that was really concrete enough to hang your hat on.
I see. Okay, thank you. Do you hold Timothy Leary responsible for the clampdown in the 1960s on psychedelics, or is the government pushback way more complicated than one man?
It's a complex situation. Certainly, Leary called attention to these substances, and at the time the Vietnam War was going on, there were a lot of war protesters, and they were also using marijuana and psychedelics, LSD. And so, you know, Richard Nixon said that these were dangerous drugs. He started the war on drugs really to suppress voting. But it was really a complicated situation. And the research on LSD was also stopped because Sandoz, who had been the ones that developed the drug, they refused to allow any access their drug master file, which you needed to do to do a clinical study. So it was really a combination of different things.
Thank you for that. Then what happened in the 1990s that got psychedelic research back on track?
Well, I have to take some of the blame for that, I suppose. I'd been doing research in this field since I was a graduate student in 1969, but I had always bemoaned the fact that nobody was doing clinical research, and there really was no clinical research. So in 1993, I went back from one of these scientific meetings where I'd been, you know, telling the same story about how, you know, you could do research on these, you just wouldn't get government funding. And I realized that I would be telling the same story till I was old and gone. And I called up some colleagues who were interested, who I'd known for years, and said, look, let's start a not-for-profit. And let's find some donors, philanthropists to support this research and start doing it again. A lot of people thought it wasn't possible, but I thought we could do it. And we basically did that. And there was also a change in personnel at the Food and Drug Administration. A fellow named Curtis Wright came in into the division that would approve these studies. And we had a meeting with the FDA Advisory Committee where they agreed that if the studies were done properly, things could start again. And so that allowed the work that Rick Strassman did in the early 90s, as well as all the studies that subsequently occurred. So there were a couple of things, but basically, with respect to the Hefter Institute, getting that started, I think that was part of it. And in addition, one of the other things that I did at Purdue was to actually make these drugs. Rick Doblin of MAPS wanted to do studies with MDMA. He had to have a large supply to do the toxicology. No one would make it for him at a cost that he could afford. And so he came to me and said, "Do you make it?" And I said, "Sure." So we made him quite a bit, and he used it for all the phase two studies that he did leading up to FDA approval. I also made the DMT that Rick Strassman used in his study, and he wrote the book and published papers on DMT, the spirit molecule. And also improved the synthesis of psilocybin and made the psilocybin for all the early studies at Johns Hopkins. So there was, a lot of the dedicated people that were involved in moving it forward. But, I think probably Hefter and some of the things that I did were catalysts in helping to move it out.
In the middle of all those transactions, I guess there's a core question that comes to mind, which is, why did you determine this sort of research was so important?
It's just one of those things. I had read enough about it and knew people who told me the stories about it, and I thought, there's all that smoke from the 50s and 60s. There must be some fire there, and I just decided nobody else was doing it, so why not? And as an academic, I had the freedom to do what I wanted, and I was fortunate to be able to get a grant from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which funded most of my work in this field for most of the time I was at Purdue. So, it was just, intense curiosity, and once I got into it, really being dedicated to the field.
Okay. So you briefly explained some of the work you did at Purdue, but could you also explain then the relationship between psychedelic research and neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine?
Well, I had two research tracks at Purdue. One was studying psychedelics, and the other was studying dopamine receptors. And those dopamine studies were designed to develop new treatments for Parkinson's disease and also for schizophrenia. And so being involved in dopamine and serotonin, these are principal neurotransmitters that are involved in many things involved in the brain, sleep and hunger, satiety, sex, motivation, etc. So a basic understanding of how those neurotransmitter systems work is necessary to do research in this area. And in fact, the psychedelics are potent activators of serotonin systems in the brain. So you really need to understand what serotonin did in the brain to really appreciate what the psychedelics did.
Thank you. So let's look more closely now at the Hefter Research Institute. Did and does that nonprofit have maintained close ties with Johns Hopkins, University of New Mexico, NYU, Stanford, who are conducting the breakthrough studies today? And largely, what is its current focus?
We've continued to get funding from philanthropists. We're trying to fund all the possible areas where psychedelics could be used. So you know that we supported the studies that were published from New York University and Johns Hopkins, giving psilocybin-assisted therapy to terminal patients, patients with a cancer diagnosis, also UCLA. We also funded the study of psilocybin-assisted therapy in alcohol use disorder at University of New Mexico, and that study has been expanded now at New York University. Michael Bogenschutz is the principal investigator. He's enrolling 100 subjects for that. Mm-hmm. We also supported the study of psilocybin-assisted therapy in long-term smokers who had been unable to quit smoking, and that was a pilot study that was done at Johns Hopkins, and that study by Matt Johnson has also been expanded now to include many more participants. We also are supporting a study of psilocybin-assisted therapy for the treatment of cocaine addiction at the University of Alabama. Also, we're doing a study now supporting a study of psilocybin-assisted therapy in obsessive-compulsive disorder. That study is started at Yale University. We're basically trying to find all the areas where psychedelic-assisted therapy could be useful, with the idea that once its psilocybin-assisted therapy is approved for one indication, which the FDA only allows you to seek approval for one indication, so it will be for depression or treatment-resistant depression, we will have identified these other areas where we have significant results that will allow someone who's trained in the field, who has the proper training and credentials, to be able to use it for these other indications, because it just is not feasible to apply to the FDA for each one of these indications. The clinical trials will be $15 or $20 million each, and so you can imagine how expensive and time-consuming it would be. So we're optimistic, although normally off-label prescribing is what that is. Normally, the FDA is not really big on off-label prescribing, but in this case, because we're finding that these compounds do so many different things, which is unusual for any kind of a medication to be useful in so many different ways, we think that the FDA will allow off-label for people that are trained. If we've established the database that, for example, the alcohol use disorder, if we can show that in 100 patients, it's useful for increasing sobriety and decreasing alcohol use, we think the FDA would allow that to be used that way. So we're hopeful that's what's going to happen, because we're basically, predicating our work on the fact that we're going to identify additional areas where these could be used.
Why should the man on the street give a damn?
because quite a few people get depressed, have anxiety, have addictions of various kinds, and there are no satisfactory treatments for these. Antidepressants, this SSRIs that people take, they only work in about half of the people. They don't work very well. They have many side effects. They take a long time to start working, and you have to take them chronically for years and years and years. These are treatments that have been shown, at least so far, to be effective after one or two administrations. So imagine someone is depressed, and they can go in and have a session and be administered a psychedelic with therapy, and the depression is alleviated and gone for months or perhaps forever. So this is really a breakthrough in psychiatric medicine. In fact, psychiatry is one of the least innovative areas of medicine. And I taught medical students, and I would ask them every year, the class, how many people are going to go into different fields, and there would be OBGYN and general practice, et cetera. Almost no one ever said psychiatry. So I asked one year, I said, what about psychiatry? Are any of you going to go into psychiatry? And they all said, no. I said, why not? And they said, because you can't help people. There's nothing you can do with psychiatry. There's no drugs that really work, and it'd be so frustrating to try to treat people and not, be effective. So I think we're going to revolutionize psychiatric medicine. This is going to really change the face of treatments for many of these conditions that are just not treated well at all now.
Wow, that was a big answer. Thank you for that. So I'm going to read something, a quote from a New York Times article written by Michael Pollan, who has become a brand name in the U.S. He said, "I look forward to the day when psychedelic medicines like psilocybin, having proven their safety and efficiency in FDA-approved trials, will take their legal place in society, not only in mental health care, but in the lives of people dealing with garden-variety unhappiness or interested in spiritual exploration and personal growth. My worry is that ballot initiatives may not be the smartest way to get there. We still have a lot to learn about the immense power and potential risk of these molecules, not to mention the consequences of unrestricted use."
Yeah, that's, he raised a lot of controversy when he made that statement, because there are a lot of people that think these things, because, for example, mushrooms are naturally occurring. People should just be able to take them, on their own without supervision. And they are really powerful psychoactive substances. Maybe the majority of people could take these without supervision under some sort of controlled circumstances, but everybody couldn't do that. There are people that will suffer psychiatric disasters by taking these. And I think he's just providing a note of caution. And the Hefter Institute, basically, we've never advocated for recreational use. We've always said these things should be used under controlled conditions by trained investigators who have a doctor standing by in case something goes seriously wrong. And I really think that's the best paradigm. But, of course, there's a lot of pressure from sort of libertarians and other people that say, everybody should be able to get these. There's no reason why only the medical establishment should have access to them. And that's a debate that will probably continue to go on for many years.
Okay. So finally, what are you looking forward to most, Dr. Nichols, about returning to Telluride and the Mushroom Festival where you are preaching to the tribe?
Oh, it's always fun to preach to the choir. I was a professor for my whole life. I still like to teach. People told me I was a good teacher, starting even when I was in the ninth grade. I did, you know, teaching when one of the teachers took off. So it's always fun to get up and tell people what you know, especially with a receptive audience like this, to make connections with people, and kind of communication is a big part of this field moving forward. So I feel like it's important for me to get out and, you know, promote my message and pass on the knowledge that I have.
Thank you. This has been Susan D. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out, speaking with Dr. David Nichols at the vanguard of research in psychedelics. Thank you so much for joining me. We look forward to hearing you as a keynote on Thursday at the Telluride Mushroom Festival.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.